Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 182. My name is John. I'll stake my claim. I'll make my name. My love, my game, my vocation. This is a spoiler-filled podcast for a 40-year-old movie. Yes, 40 years old. If you have not watched Real Genius, well, first of all, what is wrong with you? And second, go watch it now. Go watch it before continuing, because not only am I going to spoil everything about the movie, I'm going to go through it from beginning to end, describing what happens. Now, there are two reasons why I'm doing this. The first reason is I'm assuming you've already seen the movie, and I want to remind you of what happened so you can reminisce along with me. The second reason, I'll get to that later. Spoilers begin right now. In the opening credits, we see a history of the weapons of war. That's what the movie is ultimately about, the next great weapon. Cave art of a man killed with a bow and arrow is the first image we see, followed by various weapons over humankind's history, from slings to guns to bombs. The title card of the movie shows a drawing of a Roman, or possibly Greek, ballista, which looks kind of like a giant crossbow that they used in sieges. Of course, crossbow is the name of the new military weapon in the movie. We start off with the bad guys. We see what turns out to be a film about a hypothetical weapon that is being built. Crossbow. A laser that can eliminate a human target from low orbit. By the way, at the end of the little demonstration film, the crossbow pilot says, "Just like shooting ducks in a barrel." It's fish, not ducks. Ducks get in a row. Fish are shot in a barrel. Idiomatically speaking, of course. Watching in the dark room are military and government men, with one arguing against a weapon that is being developed without oversight. The leader casually admits the only oversight is the CIA, and the weapon is designed for use in peacetime, and then tells his liaison to pressure Dr. Hathaway to have the laser operational by June. The dissenter leaves, still protesting the project, and the leader of the group orders him killed. Dr. Jerry Hathaway, the main antagonist, is introduced next, and everything you need to know about him is revealed in his first scene. William Atherton, probably the best 80s douchebag, but he probably has most of the great lines in the movie, starting with the beginning of the scene, where the little old lady asks, "What is Mr. Einstein really like?" Hathaway responds, "Dead." Mitch Taylor, played by Gabe Jarrett, is introduced in the same scene, and everything you need to know about him is revealed in that scene. Mitch is a smart 15-year-old, smart enough to get early enrollment into a prestigious college. His parents are clueless. He's shunned by his high school classmates, and he's an outcast because of his intelligence. And this is where Hathaway shows who he really is. He despises people who are not as smart and casually insults them. Hathaway immediately tries to indoctrinate Mitch by telling him that they are better than other people because of their intelligence. Chris Knight, played by Val Kilmer, is introduced next. And everything you need to know about him is shown in his first scene. He despises smart people who hurt others. He is equally honored to meet a fellow scientist as he is to also berate the scientist's failure that caused satellite debris to fall on Europe. He's also a little infantile, doesn't really respond well to authority, and jokes around with people who think they're supposed to be having a serious conversation. Sherry Nugel is introduced, and Chris immediately hits on her. Can't say that I blame him. Everything you absolutely need to know about Sherry is immediately revealed, and there's really only one thing you need to know. She is the ultimate sapiosexual. She is on a quest to have sex with the 10 smartest men in America. And Chris becomes her 8th conquest after she implies that the 7th, died while she was fucking him. And I'll be honest, when I first watched the movie 40 years ago, I didn't realize she was the same person who hit on Mitch midway through the movie, because in this scene, she's wearing her big old glasses, and she's not for the rest of the movie. Next up, Mitch arrives at college, and another character, the old bearded professor, makes an appearance, and he disappears until the end of the movie. Mitch goes back to his dorm room to unpack, and we are introduced to Laszlo Hollifeld, played by the great character actor John Grice. I will always think of him as Brutes from the Pretender TV series, even though most people probably know him from Napoleon Dynamite. Nothing you need to know about Laszlo is revealed. He's the only character who you don't get to know everything about in his first scene, because his story is key to everything in the movie. He and Mitch just stare at each other as Laszlo walks into the closet, closes the door, and when Mitch opens the door, Laszlo is gone. Oh, and on the closet floor is an issue of Vigilante, Volume 1, Issue 13, cover art by the great Gil Kane. Vigilante is a gritty, tragic comic book character created by Marv Wolfman and George Perez. He's had 2 live-action adaptations. The first was an Arrow, which totally messed up the costume and changed the character from anti-hero to psychotic villain. The second was in Peacemaker, which got the costume pretty much perfect, but turned the character into a sycophant starfucker. Nothing like the original comic book character. Mitch and Chris have their first meeting, and Chris tries to show Mitch by example what he outright tells him later on about the secret to getting through the college experience for someone with a high IQ. When they fall to the floor, there's a copy of the new Teen Titans, Volume 2, Issue 4, by Marv Wolfman and George Perez. This is the penultimate issue of the Terror of Trigon storyline, which is my all-time favorite Teen Titan story. Yes, even more than the Judas Contract. That storyline was poorly done in the Titans television series, which would be the worst show DC has had this millennium if it weren't for Gotham. There are other comics underneath it, but I couldn't identify the covers. What I'm trying to point out here is Chris Knight is a DC Comics fan. A quick scene to discover that Hathaway, as he rides in a car with the liaison, is afraid of an audit on the laser funding because he has used some of it on his gaudy house. he has to get the laser they want for their weapon, not only because the military guys are dangerous, but because he will be in major trouble for diverting the funding for personal expenses. Hathaway also berates the workers at his house for not having an education, but I'd like to see that asshole do the renovations to his house with their levels of expertise. However, he does say one very profound thing in the car that real-world politicians just don't comprehend. You can't dictate innovation. As the government duopoly grows, politicians on both sides think they can just tell science and industry what the guidelines should be, and it will be magically done. That's just not the way it works. And then we meet Mitch's antagonist, Kent, and his two toadies. Everything you need to know about Kent is revealed in his first scene. Kent fancies himself to be in charge of the laser experiment because he's Hathaway's gopher. He incessantly mocks Mitch after initially mistaking him for a sandwich delivery man. And then he tries to bully Mitch before Hathaway shows up. And that scene also has another great line when one of the toadies, Brody, confesses how he's stopped his stuttering. Brody says, "I've been giving myself shock treatments." Hathaway replies, "Up the voltage." Brilliant delivery by both of the actors. Kent and his toadies are put in their place when Mitch solves their laser issues by catching a small detail that they missed. Missing a small detail will come back into play later. And Mitch solving the problem gives Kent all the motivation he needs to try to belittle Mitch to get himself back up the pecking order. Next up is the ice skating in the dorm scene and the first needle drop on Summertime Girls by Y&T, a video I loved as a kid, and I think most teenage boys would. Ick is introduced as one of Chris's associates, and this is the difference between the two groups of students. Chris, Mitch, Laszlo, Ick, and Jordan are a team. One may or may not be a little smarter than the others, but they respect each other, and they work together. Kent is the bully, who thinks that he should have it all because he sucks up to Hathaway. He has no respect for his group, even slapping Brody on the head at one point. As Summertime Girls plays out and gets to the shouted phrase, "She's hot," Jordan appears on the screen. Everything you need to know about Jordan is revealed in her first scene. 20 years before the phrase was coined, Jordan is the manic pixie dream girl, with very literal emphasis on manic and, thanks to her haircut, pixie. Now, unlike the negative connotation put on the phrase, Jordan is in no way only there for emotional support. She is part of the team. Chris actually helps Mitch farther along in his journey than anybody else, including Jordan. She is the love interest, and she holds her own with the rest of the team, and she's treated with equality and respect. Now, let's get the modern problem out of the way. Mitch is introduced as a 15-year-old, and this is his first year at college. He is, at most, 16 years old by the end of the movie. Jordan mentions midway through the movie that she is 19, which, these days, would be considered statutory rape if she and Mitch had sex. And even if they were only dating, it would at the very least make her a societal pariah. At some point, you gotta remember it's just an 80s comedy movie with touches of science fiction, and stop worrying about it. Kent shows up near the end of the ice skating scene and we immediately see Chris and Ick get the better of him. Now that all the players are introduced, the story starts to build. Mitch can't figure out how Laszlo disappears in the closet. Jordan justifiably has no roommate. Chris shows how he gets free stuff from the vending machines, which is the Chekhov's gun for the movie. So we come to the first musical montage with the song I'm Falling by ComSat Angels. You're welcome if you've ever wondered what that song is. Everyone settles into their routine. Mitch tries to keep an eye on Laszlo. Kent gives Mitch a hard time. Chris doesn't take class seriously. But my favorite part of the montage is the progression of the recording devices in the classroom. First, the classroom is full of students. And then more and more students set up tape recorders to record the professor's lecture. Until at the end, Mitch walks into a room full of tape recorders at the desks and the teacher's tape recorder playing in front. After the end of the montage, Mitch figures out how Laszlo disappears in the closet. After he closes himself inside, a secret door opens up. So Mitch does it, and Laszlo already has signs up to show Mitch the way down to the sub-basement where he lives. Mitch watches him in silence, but they don't talk to each other at all. Chris meets Hathaway at his house. Again, great dialogue. Hathaway, just coming back from jogging, asks Chris, "You still run?" Chris replies, "Only when chased." I want people to ask me if I run just so I can respond with that line. We learn that Hathaway hates popcorn. Chris, eating a bag of it, just drops it at the front door. Now, when they go inside and they sit down and talk, watch Chris's face as they're sitting in the study while Hathaway berates him. Chris, for comedic effect, first acts all proud of what he's hearing, and then he immediately switches to acting shamed. I bring that up because I actually pulled that on a teacher once in high school when he was getting on me for being a disruption in class. My friend was watching me while it happened, and after we walked out of the room, he burst into laughter. Next up, Mitch is working in the lab, and he's frustrated. Chris advises him to start up the laser, and Mitch goes into the back while Chris sets up a hidden mirror to hatch his plan. And I really love how Chris keeps telling Mitch to take his time, and literally 2 seconds after he has his mirror set up, shouts out, "What is taking so long?" I laugh at that every time. The laser comes on, and the beam reflects off the mirror and out of the room, where it continues to reflect off other mirrors. Chris takes Mitch from the lab, and they're joined by other guys from the dorm, and they follow the beam, which leads to a party with girls from a local beautician school. I like for you to watch the guys who walk into the party with Chris. The guy who says, "They're not from around here, I know," is Dean Devlin, who would go on to produce movies like Stargate, Independence Day, and the Matthew Broderick Godzilla. The guy who says, "They're beauticians," should be familiar. It's Yuji Akimoto, who played Chosen, the bad guy in Karate Kid 2, and later in Cobra Kai. Everybody begins to have fun, but of course, minutes later, Kent sees Chris and Mitch at the party. Meanwhile, Don, the liaison between the military and Hathaway, pops up again, trying to pressure the results needed for the laser. They're obviously getting angry about it because Don is in public, where Hathaway is filming his local science show, instead of privately like he usually is. While trying to film the show, Kent shows up to tell Hathaway about the party, who wants to go there immediately. Chris, by this time, has snuck away with one of the beauticians, and Mitch is in the makeshift pool helping Jordan test a rebreather as Hathaway and Kent arrive. With no Chris around, Mitch receives the full wrath of Hathaway in front of everybody. Mitch then goes back to the lab, but, unable to concentrate, goes to call his parents from an office phone. Kent realizes what's happening and records the call. The next morning, Kent plays that distraught call from Mitch to his parents in the cafeteria and publicly humiliates Mitch. Two things here. First, while I have never had something on that level done to me, if you want to be on my shit list, that's the easiest way to do it. If you publicly humiliate me, I will sever ties with you faster than it takes Kamala Harris to laugh uncomfortably in an interview. Second, this gives a whole different look at his parents, who, in their only other scene on camera, are shown as an overbearing mother and a money-conscious father, but both are equally clueless. They've already given their 15, maybe 16-year-old son's room out to a renter. And they don't just sound like they want him to tough it out. They sound like they don't want him back. Mitch starts packing his things to leave, but Chris intervenes. At first he tries humor, but it doesn't work. Chris then confesses he was trying to get Mitch to relax, and talks about how he used to be just as diligent as Mitch with his studies, until he finally met and talked with Laszlo, and discovered that Laszlo used to be the top brain at the school, according to Chris, smarter than both of them put together. He tells Mitch that Laszlo stressed over his studies just like Mitch did, until Laszlo cracked because he discovered that his creations were being used to hurt people. At that point, Chris learned the lesson that he needed to do more than just concentrate solely on his classwork. He had to have fun and do more than just science. Mitch finally understands and agrees to stay with the first order of business of getting even with Kent. They dismantle Kent's car and then reassemble it inside his dorm room. Next, with pressure from the military coming down on him, Hathaway tells Chris that the job he was promised after graduation will be given to Kent. Hathaway is going to flunk Chris out of school, even if he passes, and he's going to ruin Chris's reputation with the scientific community so he'll never be able to work in it. This time, Chris is going to leave, delivering another great line. I was thinking of the immortal words of Socrates when he said, "I drank what?" It's Mitch's turn to intervene, first trying humor to no avail, and then reasoning with Chris using his same arguments until Chris decides to stay. Next is the second and final musical montage, featuring the song Number One by Chaz Jankel. Again, you're welcome if you're wondering what that song was. This time, we see Chris being more serious with his studies and with lab work, even while incorporating some fun into it. It's getting close to finals, and everybody is trying their best. But when one student cracks into a screaming fit in the common room and runs off while the rest just silently watch, Ick casually takes a seat and everyone continues studying. At the end of the montage, Chris and Mitch are alone in the common room when Laszlo walks in. He reveals that he is putting in 1,650,000 entries into a Frito-Lay contest because he's realized that he has some materialistic needs. But He's also memorized every question Hathaway has ever asked in a final and is going to give it to Chris and Mitch to help them pass. Now, I love that Chris assumes that the contest entries that Laszlo is carrying are the questions from Hathaway's tests. And he asks, are those they? Which is grammatically correct. I only mention this because Henchman 21 corrects Henchman 24 about the proper grammar of that same question in the second season of Venture Brothers. And I can't help but think about it every time I see it now. Later, Mitch goes into the dorm room and finds Sherry Nugel waiting for him. She wants him to be number 9 on her conquest list. But he can't do it, and he goes to see Jordan instead to confess his feelings for her. And just as an aside, you'd have to think that Hathaway would be one of the top 10 smartest people in America. So I think it's safe to assume that Sherry has slept with both Hathaway and Chris, and she tries to seduce a 15, maybe 16-year-old Mitch. And Sherry says that she's waited for him to be old enough. What was the age of consent in California in 1985? I'm assuming it's California because the fictional Pacific Tech University was filmed at Caltech, but maybe it's supposed to be Oregon or Washington. I really didn't want to go searching for age of consent in states because, ew. It does remind me, though, of one of the craziest lines in Archer, where in the second season, he tells a 16-year-old girl, and literally, the minute you turn 18, please call me. Classic Archer. Anyway, on the day of the final, Chris aces Hathaway's test, then goes back to the lab to run the laser. But Kent has sabotaged it. Chris misses the small detail of checking that the optics on the laser are clean, and the laser has a meltdown. Back in the dorm, Kent mocks Chris for his failure. And as Chris is venting his frustrations, he knocks the canister of dry ice out of the refrigerator and gets the inspiration to get the laser to work at the level Hathaway wants. Just so you know, at the time, his solution was actual scientific theory. Chris finds Mitch to get the laser set up, and then he brings Hathaway, Kent, and the toadies back to the lab, and the laser works. Awestruck, Jerry gives the post-graduation job back to Chris, which sends Kent into a tirade. Chris and the team go off to celebrate, but Laszlo finds them and asks them why Hathaway needs that kind of power from a laser. At first, Chris and Mitch both dismiss the question, but Laszlo presents the facts of what they created, and Chris realizes they've just created a weapon. Laszlo's history is repeating on Chris. They go back to the lab to find everything's been taken. The team figures Kent is the way to find information, so they gas his room, and while he's knocked out, they install a small device in his braces to make him think he's hearing the voice of Jesus. I know, it's silly, but it's funny. They find out when it's going to happen, but not where. Ick trails Hathaway to an Air Force base, and knowing that Hathaway will be on the base, they make a plan. They break into Hathaway's house and fill the entryway with popcorn kernels. Back at the college, Jordan makes fake IDs for Chris and Mitch to get on the base while Laszlo breaks into their computer system. Chris and Mitch drive out to the base and talk their way past the security guard, in the process calling him airborne, which I'm told is something you should never do unless you want to get your ass kicked. But disguised as scientists, they manage to get on board the plane that will carry the laser on its test run. They switch computer chips to allow Laszlo to access and change the target location. Hathaway and the military personnel board the plane for a final check, but Chris and Mitch manage to hide just after Laszlo finishes his work. The two slip out of the plane and off the base. The next morning, just before the test, they again talk to Kent through the receiver in his brace, thinking that it's Jesus, and convince him to go to Hathaway's house and wait outside for a sign from God. The team reassembles across the street from Hathaway's house, bringing the old bearded professor from earlier in the movie and a congressman by convincing them that it was a matter of international importance. Kent arrives walking down the street. How he didn't see the group standing across the street is beyond me. And, unable to get Jesus to talk to him again, Kent goes against what he was told earlier and enters the house. Moments later, the laser is fired, but of course instead of going to its intended target for the military guys, it hits Hathaway's house and cooks the popcorn kernels inside. The team realizes that they put too much in there, because the house is filled up to a point where the windows, and eventually the house itself, breaks open, destroying it. But Kent spills out safely on a popcorn wave. By the way, given the power we saw from the laser when they first tested it, it should have cut through the house like butter. It was definitely weaker. While not shown on the screen, it is now assumed that the congressman has seen proof that an illegal weapon was made by the military, and the old professor knows that it was done with the help of Hathaway. From the base, Hathaway tracks the laser blast and discovers it hit his house. The team watches the piles of popcorn while Laszlo pulls up in an RV and all his winnings from the Frito-Lay contest. Slightly discouraged that he only won 31.8% of the prizes instead of his predicted 32.6%. Sherry Nugel is with him, having finally found number one on her list of smartest men in America. They announce that they're getting married and moving to Wyoming and drive away. As Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears plays, the team watches triumphantly as the neighborhood kids dive into the popcorn spilling out into the lawn. And don't get me started on the fact that along with the popcorn should be a lot of broken glass and wood splinters. That evening, Hathaway returns to his house as children run past with wheelbarrows and wagons filled with popcorn. He stands at the fence, covering his mouth with his handkerchief because he hates the smell, and the neighborhood dog that he's been shooing away all movie comes to his side and sits down. The end. Now, why did I just go through the movie from beginning to end? Well, I gave you the first reason up front. I wanted to remind you about everything in the movie because I want to reminisce. The second is because I love everything about this movie. I love the nuances. I love the wit in the writing. I love the delivery of the actors. It's an underrated movie that gets lost in the conversation of great 80s teen movies. When I first saw Real Genius, I wanted to hang out with that team of friends, even if I was nowhere near as smart. I had a crush on Jordan, even as frenetic as she was. I wanted to get revenge on Hathaway, and I wanted to pull pranks on Kent. I didn't get that feeling as much from any other 80s teen movie. I mean, Ferris Bueller seems a little elitist. you know, keeping a small group of friends, and he's less inviting to other people. The Breakfast Club? Well, they're certainly more realistic, but they're also kind of snobs in their own way, not yet ready or willing to break out of their shells and grow. Back to the Future? Weird Science? Yeah, those are a lot of fun, but also pretty damn dangerous and unpredictable. I'm not trying to lessen the greatness of those movies, nor am I saying Real Genius is the best teen movie of the 80s. I'm saying that if I could live inside the world of a fictional 80s movie, Real Genius is the world I would want to live in. And of course, I'm talking about this movie because just a few days ago on April 1st, Val Kilmer passed away. I've rewatched Real Genius 3 times since he passed away 3 days ago as of this recording, because I wanted to see him in his youth, and because I wanted to make sure I got every detail I liked into this podcast. I'm actually playing it on mute as I record this. Right now they're making their way into the base. This is my favorite Val Kilmer movie. And yes, Top Secret was funnier. Tombstone was more manly. Heat was more critically acclaimed. Top Gun Maverick was more poignant. But Real Genius? That's the one where you don't take life too seriously. That you balance yourself so you don't become too obsessive. And that you stand up for your friends and help them through their problems. You know, reading up on it, different people say different things about the kind of person Val Kilmer was. Some directors and actors seem to hate his guts, including Joel Schumacher. But why do I care about the opinion of the guy who ruined Batman? Other people who met him talk about how great he was. I never met him, and I never will. So, I just choose to think of him as Chris Knight, a fun, eclectic guy who cares about his friends. A toast to Val Kilmer. May he rest in peace, and may his loved ones who survive him find the comfort they need to cope with his loss. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.